Hello, and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm executive director at American Compass, and we recently released a new report. It's an entire book called Rebuilding American Capitalism, a handbook for conservative policymakers. It presents what we consider to be both a comprehensive diagnosis of what has gone wrong with the American economy in recent decades and an agenda for setting things right again. To celebrate the release, we hosted a forum on Capitol Hill to discuss conservative economics with a number of senators who have been leaders in the field, Senator Tom Cotton, Senator Todd Young, Senator Marco Rubio, and Senator J.D. Vance. And now we are releasing a series of podcasts to highlight those conversations. Please be sure to check out the full handbook at AmericanCompass.org and on the Rebuilding American Capitalism homepage, where you'll find a link to watch the forum in its entirety. Today's conversation is with Senator Marco Rubio. Senator Marco Rubio has been leading the conversation on conservative economics for a number of years, going all the way back at least to his speech at Catholic University in 2019 on common good capitalism and through a series of reports that his office published on issues like Chinese industrial policy and the problems with investment in America and a range of innovative legislative proposals. He has a new book out called Decades of Decadence that goes into these issues further. And we were privileged to have the honor opportunity to speak with him about what he addresses in that book, his thinking about what has gone wrong, particularly with globalization, and the types of policies we are going to need to recover. We hope you enjoy.
The book is probably, I don't say the culmination, but it's the product of like a 5 or 6 year process in my own life. I always tell people, if you're not evolving like in your principles, but evolving in your view of the world, learning new things, being exposed to new things, you're not alive. It's a part of life. And, you know, certainly I have a different view on things like outside of politics that I did 25 years ago. You know, I understand my parents better as my kids get to a certain age. Now I understand why they said or did certain things. In fact, I oftentimes remind myself of my own parents, and I tell my kids that all the time. One day you'll look back and remember this, and I think it's the same is true for politics. I'm a product of the late 20th century, early 21st century American conservatism. That's where I grew up, and it was the world where Ronald Reagan was president, the Cold War, or I guess with Reagan when I was growing up, and then George H.W. Bush, and the Cold War had ended. So understand something like this adversary that our entire life had been built around. If you lived in the 80s or grew up in the 80s, you know that like the scary movies about the end of the world, they all revolved around some war with the Soviet Union. All that just vanished overnight. Like the Berlin Wall comes down. And the argument is, guys, we won the Cold War, and now everyone is going to be a democracy and everyone's going to be a free enterprise economy. And it sounded great. And there was reason to believe and reason to be hopeful of that. I think there's a couple things that were missed in the euphoria of that moment. The first is that nationhood has always mattered. The idea that being citizens of the global economy, you know, that somehow that would replace nation state and the importance of place and things of that nature was pretty silly. There's no evidence in 5,500 years of recorded human history that people don't need to belong particularly to a place, but it's one of the most basic of human desires is to belong to something. That's why no matter where you put people, they immediately start creating groups and organizations and so forth. So I think that was a mistake. And I think the second, and embedded in that mistake was also the notion, which is where the decadence piece comes in, that we are now America, we're our sole superpower, everything's going our way, we can do whatever we want. In fact, we have so much runway that we can actually go crazy and decide that all these things that are true are no longer true, all these things that work or actually don't work anymore, and in fact are inherently evil and so forth. And the two things kind of start moving together on the cultural side and on the economic side. On the economic side, clearly, I think the right of center is as guilty as the left of center on the idea that somehow we are all now just consumers and investors in this global economy. Because when you believe that, then it really doesn't matter where you make things. If the market says, take this factory and take those jobs and move it overseas because that's the most efficient use and the product, and the end product is going to be more profits for the investors and lower prices for the consumer. Left unanswered, of course, is, well, what happens to all those people whose jobs went away? Of course, for a long time, the answer was, well, they're going to learn how to code and they're going to, you know, or they're going to go out and find an even better paying job. And that clearly didn't happen. And the result wasn't just unemployment. It was corrosive and destructive and undermined entire communities. I mean, it just pulled the soul out of them. J.D. Vance obviously wrote a book about that and does a great job of explaining it. I know he'll be here later. And it really touches on the impact of that beyond just economics. And then embedded in that on the cultural side is the idea that some of these most fundamental elements and pillars of a functioning society really didn't matter anymore. Things like family and community, that somehow we found our strength now in government or in the... And so we're left to people out there like desperately in search of belonging, but told you can't belong to a country because it's not patriotic. There's no patriotism is actually a bad thing. And America is not a country who has a great history to begin with. That's the argument. Family is whoever wants it to be. The actual notion of family is not nearly as important as some of these other things. So you begin to undermine all of those things as well that hold the culture together. And now it's just a full-blown cultural hysteria. Again, both a product of this incredible success that creates the idea that we can do whatever we want. Well, hindsight 20, 30 years, it mattered a lot. Because we now find that not only did we create these pockets of despair in America, but we also have found ourselves deindustrialized and unable to make things we invented. So we passed things like this, well, I didn't vote for it, but we passed for this fake Inflation Reduction Act, which is you gotta buy batteries, you gotta buy solar panels, but they're all made in China. We innovated it, but now we find the only way to meet the demands of that bill that we passed is to make them in China. And we have this very dangerous pharmaceutical. I'm just touching on a handful of things. I mean, the list is long and extensive about the shortages we face. We deindustrialized America because we were not going to be the people that invented things. We created an unbalanced economy. And what I mean by that is it's an economy where the pillars of it are services and finance. And there's nothing wrong. These are not cocaine dealers. I mean, it's not illegal to be in finance or in services, but you can't be a great power if you don't have industrial capability. And of course, we're ignoring the impact that jobs and all that have as well. So we have an unbalanced economy in that way. And so I think we're really at a very important inflection point. And for the challenge for people like me, right, I grew up in that era where the market was always the answer. And I still believe in the market. I still believe that generally the market outcome is the right outcome. I think the challenge has to be now, what do you do when the market outcome and the national interest are in conflict? Because the market says it is more efficient to make medicine in China, basically make anything in China, but it's not in our national interest. So, and it's certainly not in our national interest to create these pockets of despair as well in America. So what do you do? And that's the piece of policymaking that I think was lost, and that is putting the national interest at play in making these decisions. We weighted as solely an economic function and did not look at the broader point of view. And for government officials in particular, that's problematic because our job is, first and foremost, our obligation to the country. And our view, I believe, has to be America is not a market. Market is a tool. It is a tool that we use to strengthen America and improve American lives. It is a better tool than socialism and government, but it is a tool. The end game here is to support the country and our people, not to serve the market. And so the market's a tool, we do that. And when the two are in conflict, when the pure market outcome, when the lab outcome for the market is not good for the country, the only people on earth that can be expected to put the American interest above the market outcome is American policyholders. The corporate class isn't going to do that for a lot of reasons, and certainly other countries aren't going to do that as well. So we now find ourselves in a pretty precarious situation with a culture that I think is fracturing deeply in ways that make it difficult for us to rally around some of these concepts, and some real economic imbalances that are both dangerous to our national security and corrosive to our national life. And so finding a path forward on this that comes from the limited government point of view that I still hold has been one of the things I've really tried to embrace and work on over the last 5 or 6 years, not me alone, but it's a project that I think is starting to get some momentum, and I hope we can continue to build it. The last point I would make is this, there's a lot of things that aren't fun these days about this job, but the one thing that is that we are living in a moment of tectonic shift, a real realignment of politics internationally, but also domestically, where some of the traditional lines of the old political spectrum are being blurred a little bit. And where I think you can find some compromise between or some solutions between people that may not agree on a lot of other things, but may find themselves sort of for different reasons believing in some of the same things I've outlined here now. So I do think there's this realignment of American politics, not just partisan realignment, but the ideological spectrum is evolving in a very interesting way that I think it's an exciting chance to be a part of trying to build a new governing consensus, which our country needs. And so that's why I'm grateful for the work you guys do, because you've really provided a lot of the sort of intellectual work behind some of these ideas. And obviously our job is to go out and try to figure out how to apply it and operationalize it.
So what do you
do? That's longer than my book. My book's only 254 pages. So I just basically... Yeah.
That's read the book. So what do you do? I mean, you posed it sort of rhetorically. What do you do when you have these problems? We have piles of things you could do. What are you most excited about? What do you see as the main thing we need to do?
Yeah, I think the first question and I think this is true of any challenge, is you have to answer the why. Why is this important? Because we are still basically hardwired to think, like, the stock market's up or the stock market's down, that's good. And I think this concept that just because a company has an address in the United States doesn't mean that what's in their interest is America's best interest. Their investors are international. And at the end of the day, their number one obligation, in their view, is, appropriately so perhaps, is to their shareholders. My number one obligation is to our shareholders, which happens to be the people of the United States of America. That's who we're here acting on our behalf. And when the two are in conflict, in our mind, the shareholders, the United States of America, the people of our country have to win out. So I do think we have to be careful about two things. The first is we have to be careful about how you define the national interest, because every industry will argue that they are in the national interest. And I think they can, I think, not that any industry is irrelevant, but I do think that there's a hierarchy of things that are important in the 21st century because they're important to our security and also because they produce the kind of stable work that you need to have strong families and strong communities. So that's a tough task because everyone's going to hire lobbyists to convince us that they're in the national interest. I try to stay away from singling out one industry versus another, but I will say that I think textiles and apparel are important. I think telecommunications and biomedicine is perhaps a little bit more elevated given I think we could survive wearing Chinese t-shirts, although I'd love to have at least Central American t-shirts, so it's closer, but I don't think our country can survive as a great power if we depend on China for our medicine, any advances in medicine, telecommunications and technology and the like. So I think those are important. Likewise with agriculture, which a lot of people don't think about as a critical industry, but it really is. And so I think we have to do a better job of defining that. And I still think on my end, we have to be careful and guard against, because the left of center traditional response to any of this is, well, here comes the government. The government will run it. So we have to... There has to be a government role to play, but we have to make sure it doesn't overreach, or you end up passing, what's the bill that they passed, the semiconductor bill, which I was an original supporter of the idea that we should be in it. So I said, hey, by the way, if we're going to invest all this money, shouldn't we put some guardrails, right? Because they're already stealing our stuff. So before we turn over billions of dollars to make even more stuff, shouldn't we make sure they don't steal it? Because if they're stealing billions now and we invest billions more, they'll have billions more to steal. And I got tremendous pushback. It never made it in the bill because the companies that do this work and the researchers don't want those restrictions. They want to continue to collaborate. So we have to be careful about examples of industrial policy that end up being counterproductive. 5 years from now, when the articles are written about how the U.S. invested billions of dollars in semiconductors and it was all stolen by China anyways, no one's going to want to do industrial policy because it'll stigmatize it. So that'll be problematic. So that's the second thing we have to guard against. And then the third, frankly, is in my own party. The orthodoxy still is, in some circles, that the market will take care of all of this. And that may have been true when there wasn't a lot of options 40 or 50 years ago, but in the global market, the way it operates now, the market outcome isn't always going to be in America's national interest. There are some things, and we've always done that, by the way. The reason why Boeing exists, 50% of the revenue comes from the Department of Defense. Because we decided a long time ago that we better build airplanes for the Air Force. We shouldn't rely on China to make our airplanes. So I think it's important to understand we've always made these decisions. I just think we're going to have to expand the industries that we define. But I still think there are obviously strong and powerful elements within the right of center that still cling to this 20th century notion. And many have built their lives or career around it. And others have just made a lot of money on it and don't want to give it up. So we have a lot of work to do. We're still the minority, but we're working on growing.
Yeah, China seems like the biggest challenge in some sense is also the most appetizing on-ramp for people who might be much more inclined to laissez-faire, free market in a lot of contexts, but they're ready to say, okay, but there's a problem with China. And so I think something like the CHIPS Act example is really interesting. Right now, we basically have open season, or have historically had open season, go invest as much as you want in China. one question, the CHIPS Act was, okay, well, should we say certain companies, if they do certain things, can't invest in China? The Biden administration has made certain rules, maybe. How do you approach a question like that? Would you be inclined to just say chip companies can't invest in China? Or how do we start to disentangle that?
Well, the way they've argued is they want to continue to make what they call legacy chips in China. The problem is money's fungible. Like once you provide investment to a corporate entity, even if they invest the actual dollar you gave them in America, it just frees up a dollar for them to continue to expand operations and you're still building their industrial capacity. But I want to take one step back from that and say, look, China is the single most powerful rival potential adversary the United States has ever faced in its history. It dwarfs anything the Soviet Union ever posed. And I was tough on China before it was cool, right? So everybody now has got a bill out there to be tough on China, and that's fine. And I don't have a problem with that. I think that's a dynamic that didn't exist a few years ago. But I don't want to be mistaken. This is not just about China, and that's the part I'm worried about. China is a piece of it. It's certainly the most prominent example, and it features prominently in the book. But it's not just about China. A lot of it is about us. We made the decision that we didn't want to be an industrial power anymore because industry was dirty, and industry was for people that didn't go to college, and industry was, you know, not... You know, can't make Netflix movies off of industry. We all wanted to be, you know, stockbrokers and so forth and whatever movies were out, lawyers, too many of those, even though I'm one, but I'm recovering. And so I think part of it is internal. We made policy decisions that are now, and the other is it's not just limited to China. There is this rise of countries around the world that if you look at, if BRICS added the BRICS countries, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, if they added a couple more countries, say Argentina and Saudi Arabia, you have 60% of the global economy, about 56% of GDP. It rivals the G7. And if they all decided we're going to start doing deals around the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, that's a real threat. And there's two things that are conspiring. One is, and I've been a supporter of sanctions, but at some point you sanction enough people that you've created this entire marketplace of the sanctioned, which is big enough to conduct business around you to get around sanctions and things of that nature.
You put everyone in jail and now all the criminals are together in jail.
It's now the biggest city in your state, right? And that's one of the challenges that we face. So I don't want to just say, one of the things that COVID did, I think most nations around the world have operated on the basis of the national interest. This idea that we should operate in the interest of the global economy is a Western phenomenon that China never bought into, the Russians never did, many others. And for most of these countries, it always made sense to act in the national interest. And they continue to do so, and we haven't. So I think one of the things you're now seeing is more and more countries, especially after COVID, when they ran out of things that they either made or had the capability of making, have now woken up to that reality and are becoming more, and this is a term that's been stigmatized, but nationalistic in their view of things. In essence, even in the West, particularly in Europe now, more and more nations are starting to think about like the national interest before the interest of even the EU and certainly the global economy. And we can't be left behind in that equation. That doesn't mean we don't want relations with other countries. That doesn't mean we don't want to isolate from, we want to isolate from the world. Those two things don't have to be true. We still can engage in the world. But I just think fundamentally, every decision we make has to be a decision that's good for America. I can't imagine why we would make decisions that are bad for America because they somehow are good for somebody else. And for a long time, we were making public policy that way. And I think that's the bigger challenge. China is a product of that. It is the Chinese leaders have done exactly what any rational leader of a nation state seeking to become a great power would do. They took advantage of all the benefits and none of the obligations of everything that we let them into. And they'll continue to do it as long as we let them do it. And, you know, so I think as much as anything else, they are a product of not just the work they've done and the money they've invested, but what we've allowed them to continue to do for a long time.
So I take your point that China is illustrative of the challenge as opposed to being the challenge. What do you think that means for particularly the conservative coalition here in Congress or in America? You mentioned this way of thinking is probably still the minority at this point. Do you feel like there is progress in the right direction? Where is there progress versus where do you think there's the most resistance?
Well, I think in some sense, for a long time, the way American politics, this is very simplified, okay? But the way American politics generally played out was, if somebody was the head of a big company or had been very successful making money by investing money, and they came and told you, this is the way to guide our economy, we would say, we need to listen to these people because they made a lot of money. But just because you know how to make a lot of money, or just because you know how to make a corporation profitable in the global economy, doesn't necessarily mean you know how to steer public policy for a nation state. Because oftentimes the interest of a nation state and the interest of a corporate entity are not just different, they're not aligned. And so I think that's one of the challenges we now face. I understand why, you know, Jamie Dimon or Elon Musk go to China and meet with the Chinese leaders, because they have an interest there. And for the entity that they work for or own, there is a profit motive for it. But they're not public officials. I think for us as policymakers, just because somebody who's made a lot of money or is very successful at business thinks that something makes sense, doesn't mean it does in the national interest. So it may make sense to them. And for a long time, that was a very powerful weapon that was used against us. I mean, especially on the right, because we didn't want to stand up to a group that was called the business whatever or the round table of whatever. And so they would come to DC and they would say, we're here on behalf of the business community, and we think this is good for America because X, Y, and Z, and we would do it because they're the business people. And I think now there has to be that equation of what might be good for your business, the way you're structured and what you particularly do, but is it also good for the country? We have to find that balance. I'm not seeking to wage war on these guys. I'm just thinking to bring some balance that leans towards the national interest. And I think that's going to be a real struggle for people on the center right who have long taken their cues by whether or not people on CNBC or Fox Business are freaking out that morning. The stock market is not irrelevant, but it is by no means a true barometer of the safety of our daily economic life or of the health of our economy as a nation. And yet, I think we put a lot of stock into things like that, no pun intended, and take our cues in that regard.
So a final question, to this point about sort of what the coalition looks like going forward. I think you sort of described the right isn't going to be just sort of in lockstep with the business community as it used to be. On the other hand, if you lose the business community, somebody else has to come in and fill it, or maybe there's a way to reach détente with the business community. What do you see as the path forward that takes what you and I would both agree is the right way to think about things and actually make sure there is the necessary support for it?
Well, first of all, I think it's a misnomer to argue that we live in laissez-faire, like hands-off government. We already have laws that do things like taxes and regulation. And anytime you put laws in place, those laws incentivize and disincentivize behavior. So we already do that. All I'm arguing is that our incentives should now be built in the direction of serving the national interest. And our disincentives should be about being against things that are against the national interest. So anything that incentivizes a company to move its production of something really important to another country, whether it be high taxes or subsidies from the government, we shouldn't do. I don't think that puts us at war with the business community. I think the business community, by and large, will respond to whatever the conditions are. Some of these corporations are making a lot of money in America, a free society, and in dictatorial communist settings as well. They've figured out how to adjust to whatever the laws and conditions are in those marketplaces. So I don't think ultimately we find ourselves in a place where we're going to be in hostile toward the broader business community, because they will respond to the conditions that are set. Whatever they are, they just want to know what those rules are. And they'll respond to those in ways that, if properly tailored, would be good for the country, but also good for economic growth, which is good for the country. I think the one place where there might be some friction is people that have invested a lot of money in companies or entities that are doing things like building weaponry in China or strengthening some capability China has. I think it makes no sense, for example, for the Thrift Savings Plan, which invests the money of federal employees and particularly of members of the military, are being invested in companies that are developing weapons to kill those members of the military. Like most people would say, don't invest my 401k money in a company designed to kill me.
It might maximize the return.
Yeah, well, exactly. But you won't be around to get the return if they blow you up. So in those cases, I do think there may be some conflict. And then, look, a great example is this Uyghur Human Rights Act that we passed, which we're having a challenge now enforcing. But we had, nobody did it publicly. You didn't see a lot of commercials saying, stand up to Congress, tell them yes to slave labor. You know, nobody said that. But they really worked hard behind the scenes to not have it pass. You know why? Because they're making a product with labor that see no evil, hear no evil, you know, and it wasn't happening. But they had to have known that this was forced labor. Of course it was cheap, it was forced. and it and allowed their price point to be lower and made them competitive in the marketplace. So I think there's an adjustment there. Our biggest challenge is going to be the American people. And the reason why is a lot of people would agree with us. Yeah, we got to be tough on China. We got to stand up to China. But don't take away my TikTok. Like, can't touch that. You know, you can't, what's Shein or whatever. Like, I still want to be able to buy that shirt for $19, even as we're tough on China. So I do think we're going to ask people to do things that are uncomfortable if we're going to act in the national interest that political leaders don't like to do. And so I think that also creates a dynamic that we're going to have to bear watching. But I don't think this puts us in a hostile position. But I do think that in the end, we have to view what's in the national interest. And the national interest isn't just national security from a traditional sense. It also involves, the bottom line is this, guys. We're never going to be a strong country if we can't make things and if we don't have strong families that live in strong communities. It's that simple. Okay, we need those three things. America became strong because of those three things. We have undermined all three things. Not just neglected, openly undermined all three things. The authority of parents, the undermined community, or at least community as we understood it, and obviously looked away from our economic resiliency and our national security in that vein. So we're going to need I think it's a wake-up call that we are no longer in a position where we can do whatever we want and not have to worry about the consequences. We are no longer the only show in town. We have rivals and we have competitors who are near-peer adversaries in the case of China. And the world has changed, and we need to change with it and take that very seriously, or we are going to wake up one day and live in a world that's going to look very different than the one we grew up in. And then we won't be worried about decadence. It'll be panic and servitude, and the most powerful nation on earth will be a communist dictatorial regime, and the world will change as a result of it. The stakes are truly that dramatic.
Well, on that note,
yeah. Senator, other than that, it's going good. No, but I mean,
thank you so much, Senator, for everything you're doing. Really appreciate you being here.